Hi-ho, folks. It's time for the Indie Week. It's presented by the North Carolina Reading Service for our blind and print-impaired listeners. And this issue is dated May the 5th, 2021, and it's read by me. Oh, yes, my name is John Federson. Because I've already yammered away long enough, there's no time, unfortunately, left to thank our theme song musicians today, and we offer them our heartfelt apologies for being unable to appreciate them over the air this week, promising to learn from our mistakes and do better next time. And opening our issue of Indie Week, Lee Toss writes about good old Apple Computer. Is the deal to bring Apple to the Triangle as good as it sounds, or will it cost taxpayers more than bargained for? It's a pretty sweet deal. Apple announced last week it would spend $1 billion to construct a new Eastern headquarters in Research Triangle Park in exchange for $846 million in state grants and $20 million in county property tax breaks over the next 3 decades. In other words, we're giving them 9 apples to get 10. It's the largest incentive package of this kind that North Carolina has ever awarded, but officials maintain it's well worth the price tag due to the economic growth the tech giant could bring to the region, which Apple claims will be worth $1.5 billion. But others worry it will only exaggerate the Triangle's burgeoning affordability crisis and ultimately could cost taxpayers more in the long run on education and infrastructure updates to accommodate the growth. Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin told the Indy, "Yes, I think it's great news. Does it bring challenges with it? Yes. We already have a housing shortage, and we are really going to have to focus on how we build supply to keep up with that demand." Well, Samuel Gunter, executive director of the North Carolina Housing Coalition, says it's not that simple. Quote, "Even when that supply and demand is in some sort of balance, it never works for folks at the lowest end of the income spectrum, those folks at 30% area, median income and below. As housing prices are going up, incomes at the bottom aren't. So while there may be some jobs that are added that are better paying or going to raise the area median income, the folks that work for minimum wage are still making minimum wage." Apple's RTP hub is part of a $430 billion expansion the company's planning nationwide that will create 20,000 new jobs in the Triangle. That includes the construction of that new million-square-foot research campus next to Highway 540 near the border of Cary and Morrisville. The half-a-billion-dollar headquarters will bring with it the creation of 3,000 new jobs, which Apple says will pay an average salary of $187,000 per year. That's about 3 times the current average wage in Wake County, which was $64,000 in 2019. But according to Duke Sanford School of Public Policy professor John Quinterno, it's probably too good to be true. And he told the Indy, "The reason the average is so high has to be that they're planning to move some high-level executives out here, and those outliers are going to pull up the average for everyone else. These are good jobs, but they're not necessarily that superstar salary level." That's not the only reason Quinterno is skeptical. For him, the biggest sticking point is the sticker price. Why should North Carolina dish out massive subsidies to a company that in all likelihood was probably going to come here anyway? And he says it's all wasted money at that point, whether it's $1 billion or $100 in subsidy. If you're providing an incentive for a company to do what it was going to do in the first place, that's not an incentive. That's essentially then directing money that otherwise would be public money available for public purposes to invest in roads, schools, and parks. It's no secret the state's power brokers had been courting Apple for years, and Apple already owned that land in RTP. Nor is it secret that several high-level executives at Apple have extensive ties to the Triangle. Tim Cook Apple's CEO, earned his MBA from Duke University. Jeff Williams, who has been Apple's COO since 2015, graduated from Sanderson High School and has degrees from North Carolina State University and Duke. And Williams said, as a North Carolina native, I'm thrilled Apple is expanding and creating new long-term job opportunities in the community I grew up in. Apple has been part of North Carolina for nearly two decades, and we're looking forward to continuing to grow and a bright future ahead. If that future looks anything like Austin, Texas, where Apple announced it would also open up a new billion-dollar campus, it may not be so bright, Gunter says. Austin recently passed a policy to essentially criminalize homelessness in the rapidly growing city. And he says, Austin is a couple years ahead of us, and I don't think Austin did a good job at all of preparing for that growth that was coming. You get to the point where communities are so overpriced, and then you start locking folks out of them. Housing prices in the Triangle were already on the rise pre-pandemic, and with lending rates at historic lows, prices are continuing to skyrocket, with some markets seeing 10% spikes in value year over year. According to the online real estate market company Zillow, the median home price in Raleigh since 2015 has ballooned by nearly 28%. While Raleigh did pass an $80 million affordable housing bond last year, Baldwin says more needs to be done on the policy and land use fronts to ensure growth keeps up with demand. That will likely mean greenlighting more density in neighborhoods that may balk at change. But the growth could also catalyze essential projects for the region, such as commuter rail, which Baldwin sees as a positive. I see it as a catalyst for all these things we need to do. Now there's a sense of urgency. The deal also includes a 50% county tax break on property taxes for improvements to that site for the next 30 years, more than twice the duration usually awarded. When the Indy asked why the Board of County Commissioners agreed to extend that subsidy beyond its usual policy, board member Sig Hutchinson replied glibly, "To get the deal." He said, these things are anything but cut and dried, and these are very, very sensitive negotiations with the most significant and successful tech company in the world. I'd say this is the biggest thing that's happened in the Triangle. This is comparable to IBM deciding to move here in the 60s. Likewise, the state's incentive package, known as a Job Development Investment Grant, JDIG, is also historically huge, and Quinterno says that leaders' willingness to cave to Apple's demands constitutes a form of corporate welfare. These sorts of deals, negotiated in secret and not by elected officials in many cases, aren't even considered politically controversial anymore. They're just accepted as the status quo, and they set a dangerous precedent. And Quinterno says no other public spending request would occur on a say-so. Nobody at the legislature says, why do we need more money for school teachers? Because school teachers say so. David Rhodes, a spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Commerce, says the historic deal was deemed necessary because it qualified as a transformative project, a relatively new category of that grant. However, Rhodes emphasized Apple gets the money only if the company makes good on its promises to add jobs and invest in the community. He told the Indy, it is indeed transformative in nature and is going to bring not just the benefits of the company itself, but other companies and other jobs will be created because they are here and will attract others. Still, Quinterno says the waived taxes will come out of taxpayers' coffers to ultimately accommodate the growth that the deal will bring to the school system, which must accommodate new students, and to new infrastructure to support more cars on the road, commuting them to the new tech hub. Quinterno says Apple will be insulated from those costs, but more of them will be borne by everybody else. If the county and state can shell out a combined $866 million to bring Apple here, Gunter says taxpayers should be demanding more to ensure the security of existing residents. And he says, Don't let anyone deceive you that the resources aren't there. It's a matter of political will. If you can scrape together those public resources to recruit a company, you can also ensure the folks at the bottom end of the economic spectrum who are working are able to live and thrive in your community. Jake Sheridan now weighs in with an article about Durham caffeine conflict. The looming arrival of a new Starbucks makes some Durham coffee lovers feel jittery. As reliably as Triangle Coffee House's drip brew flows, Victor Loperfido inhabits a cushy chair by the shop's door. In the 4 months since he moved to Durham after his father's death, he's visited daily. The people filling the bohemian joint draw in the soon-to-be 70-year-old, golden baristas, book-beguiled students, regulars with whom he swaps music. All my friends that I know in Durham frequent this place, Loperfido says. But the Ninth Street Coffee Shop, essential to Loperfido, beloved by many and a community unto itself, may soon cease to exist. A Starbucks is moving in two doors down. The new competitor could force Triangle out of business, threatening to wipe out much more than coffee. And the regular says it would break my heart if this place closed. When COVID first hit, Triangle closed for nearly 3 months. Now pandemic capacity restrictions continue to hurt business. We're barely staying afloat, says the owner, Jermaine Bantam. Triangle isn't alone. The number of independently owned coffee shops in the U.S. shrank in 2020 for the first time in a decade as the virus made sipping and lounging dangerous. Starbucks is pouring struggling cafes a double shot of disadvantage. The company announced in June that it's hastening the rollout of convenience-led drive-thrus and new takeout-only locations. Bantam expects the unopened Ninth Street Starbucks to be a pickup shop, a prediction consistent with visible renovations. A green "Coming Soon" sign hangs on the storefront's window. The iconic siren logo might as well be a pirate's skull and bones. The 32,600-store chain has long been accused of pushing out small coffee shops. Bantam says the track record speaks for itself. It's usually predatory. They end up pushing out the local businesses when they open up. It's hard to compete. Triangle opened in 2016, but the space it occupies has been home to a coffee shop for at least 20 years, he says. Bantam had plans to open a second Triangle location this summer before the pandemic hit. That's still the plan, but now he doesn't know if he'll have to close his original spot. It's definitely a possibility, he says. A broader local ecosystem would be hurt if the cafe were to close, he added. Starbucks won't get its pastries from the Ninth Street Bakery like Triangle does. Triangle looks like a mill and funk-themed fishbowl. On one side, the windows stretched from checkerboard floor to ceiling and look out onto Ninth Street. On the other, they peer into interior office space. Relentlessly colorful paintings from a local artist cover the back red brick wall. There's a black couch upstairs and two more in the basement. It wouldn't be weird to take a nap. In fact, it'd be easy to doze off if Evan Morgan, the shop's regular barista, were playing his standard mix of melodic lo-fi hip-hop. Morgan has made coffee a Triangle for 3 years. He says his boss's flexibility and a dependable community make it feel unlike work. He knows 30 customers' orders by heart. You get to know their names, their faces, what they got going on in life. When he heard Starbucks would be moving into the empty storefront, he was surprised. Ninth Street was supposed to be local. But at the end of the day, money talks, he says. The barista thinks his local shop has some edges on the mega corporate caffeinator. For starters, real coffee. He believes Starbucks brew is often burnt and too sugary. The art of coffee is just not there, he says. His roast comes from fresh, organic, shade-grown, fair trade beans, of course. And Morgan doesn't think the feelings match either. Starbucks has, quote, a more sterile corporate vibe that isn't very comfortable. Across the street and beyond a large parking lot, another Starbucks operates within a grocery store. Morgan says he doesn't know how the new one will make money with another location so close. He says he's personally not worried about losing business and never has been. He's hopeful the incoming behemoth will bring new coffee drinkers by or shed overflow crowds. Plus, regulars might rally behind his little shop. Hope aside, Morgan sees much to lose. Quote, if this place were to turn into a Starbucks or a very corporate place, you wouldn't have that same atmosphere and that same community. The song of Daniel McRae, who regularly busks outside Triangle, would very likely also disappear. He says, if this place goes, I don't know where I'll be able to play. He's sitting at a grated patio table with Morgan and a guitar. I don't think Starbucks is going to be too friendly. I'm hoping it's not going to be like all the mom-and-pop stores when Walmart came out. He continues. The gray-haired Loperfido says he's seen this one before. When he lived in California, Starbucks smoked out a Kensington cafe when it moved in Kitty Corner. He says he knew the owners. He says, there's nothing you can say to Starbucks. You can't stop their methodology. That Starbucks opening on 9th Street will be a company-operated store, not a licensed or franchised owner owned by local people. The owners won't know the other restaurants on 9th, won't chat with their regulars, and won't have heard buskers playing outside. When the Indy inquired why the company chose a location so close to a pre-existing Starbucks and another cafe, and whether any considerations were made for the impact that opening on 9th Street might have on local business, a company spokesperson gave little clarification. The full statement said, Starbucks is always looking for great locations to better meet the needs of our customers, and we are happy to confirm we will be opening a new location in Durham, North Carolina this summer. Bantam recalls big businesses kicking local ones from his native Brooklyn. He says once it gets commercialized, it kind of takes away the soul of the town. A new Chase Bank just opened across the street from Triangle. Starbucks' future storefront was formerly a dessert cafe, Tall Francesca's, which operated for 3 decades until soaring rent of costs caused the owner to fold in 2017. Bantam wishes he could get a word in now. He says, I would love to speak to somebody, some decision makers at Starbucks. Did they consider this local coffee shop's over here? Why are we opening next door? What was their thought process? From Orange County, Sarah Pequeño writes, Family Values. Hudson Vaughn was surprised when he got his tax reevaluation earlier this spring. His home, located in Chapel Hill's Northside neighborhood, was valued higher than it had been for the previous 4 years. In turn, his property taxes went up about 35%. He didn't think much of it until he spoke to a former co-worker, Kathy Atwater, a community advocacy specialist at the Marion Cheek Jackson Center. Vaughn says, I was talking to Miss Kathy, who works with a lot of older, longer-term homeowners, and she was saying that there had been tons of calls about how much some had risen. Property owners in Northside and Pine Knolls in Chapel Hill, Tin Top in Carrboro, and the rural parts of northern Orange County also saw tax hikes. The Jackson Center, which advocates on behalf of historically black neighborhoods, says that the property owners they spoke with will pay 53% more on average in property taxes due to the revaluations. The Jackson Center is appealing the revaluations of 144 properties in the North Side neighborhood alone through an informal process, according to Executive Director George Barrett. 84 of the properties they claim are overvalued are owned by long-term residents, while 32 are undervalued. Most of the undervalued properties are duplexes or homes with more than three bedrooms that are rented out to students. North Carolina's tax laws dictate that homes being revalued must be compared to homes that sold recently in the same neighborhood. Northside neighbors say the majority of those homes were newer, bigger houses that were being rented to UNC Chapel Hill students, while their homes are smaller and older. They also mentioned these newer homes, which are mostly duplexes, are no longer allowed to be built in the neighborhood. Dolores Bailey, executive director of Empowerment Incorporated, which focuses on affordable living options in the area, says she will owe $3,000 in property taxes. Her 1,300-square-foot home on 0.13 acres of land in Northside was assessed at around $300,000. Meanwhile, a nearby duplex that sold in 2019 for $750,000, a newer home with over twice the livable square footage, is paying taxes as if it's worth only $535,700. Those two were considered comparable homes in the tax assessment. Bailey says, "What you have are older residents living in these homes that haven't changed in the last 10 years, whose land value is going up based on these mega mansions that are being built and the fact we were so close to Franklin and Rosemary Streets." When leaders from the Jackson Center, Empowerment, and the Chapel Hill Carborough NAACP contacted the county's tax office, they were told that the assessors followed the same laws they're bound to by the state. If the owners believe they're overtaxed, it's on them to point it out. Informal appeals are handled by the staff and were due to the county tax administration on April the 30th. Formal appeals, which have to be done in a presentation in front of the Orange County Board of Equalization and Review, can be filed until June 30th. Advocates point out that either way, an appeals process still requires individual homeowners to correct a systemic issue, and they have to act fast to get the easiest possible process. Barrett says, "We have around 40 volunteers who are trying to mobilize and connect with neighbors to do these appeals. That is a massive amount of energy and labor in a tight amount of time to try to get something in, and that is clearly inequitable." Christopher McLaughlin, a professor at UNC School of Government, says one solution would be to hire more assessors so the neighborhoods could be divided into smaller home groupings. The issue then is county resources. McLaughlin says, "I'm not blaming the tax office, because part of it is they're given the budget to conduct every appraisal. It may be that the county itself has to say, we're willing to spend more money on this. We're going to need more staff to make sure we increase the accuracy, because we're worried about making sure we get this right and making sure there's not inequity across the board." Orange County has some of the highest property taxes in the state due to its lopsided ratio of residential to commercial properties. The county's tax rate is 86.79 cents per $100 in assessed property value, compared to a statewide average of 68 cents. This rate doesn't include Chapel Hill or Carborough property taxes or the additional property tax for Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools. The high property taxes are something that could be mitigated by development that would bring in commercial taxes, but that solution would take years, says Todd McGee, an Orange County spokesman. For folks living in these neighborhoods, waiting years for more development and better jobs is a gamble. And Barrett says, "This is like a textbook example of how process is biased. Process does have bias in how it affects individuals, and if we just rely on process and go with that process, we're actually not doing anything to take away inequities." Tomasi McDonald writes our cover article from this week's Indie Week, "How Kyron Died." Kyron Hinton's family members want to know why it took 2 years for the Wake County District Attorney's Office to reveal who was behind his death. Police never did say who was responsible for the homicide of Kyron Hitton in 2019. Now we know. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman told Indy last week it was a young man, a juvenile, who admitted trying to restrain him. Before Hinton's death, the juvenile had been charged during the same time frame with an unrelated misdemeanor and, quote, was found incompetent due to developmental disabilities, she said. And, quote, both the police chief and I understood he was unfit to stand trial. Unfortunately, people left with the perception that the case was not thoroughly investigated because someone should have been charged, and that's not true. It was a really tragic situation. Freeman's disclosure was news to Hinton's family. Dominique Sanders, Hinton's cousin, says, she never told my aunt that. So he's getting off instead of being committed to an asylum? She told you this? Vicky Hinton answered with two words when asked if Freeman had told her a child in the home had admitted to being involved in her son's death. No, never. Shannon Utley, the mother of Kyron's daughter, Kyra, described the news as strange. According to his autopsy report, Hinton died from an irregular heartbeat caused by cocaine poisoning and a fractured larynx due to strangulation. Hinton was found unconscious by paramedics on the floor of a Southeast Raleigh home. 1 day before, he had received $83,000 from Wake County as part of a settlement for being beaten by law enforcement officers in 2018, which led to criminal charges filed against a sheriff's deputy and two state troopers. A day later, after receiving $3,000 of the settlement money, Hinton, a 30-year-old black man with a history of severe mental illness and drug abuse, was found mortally injured. 2 months after Hinton's autopsy was made public, Freeman announced no charges would be filed in the case due to insufficient evidence of foul play. Before that disclosure on Friday, the circumstances surrounding Hinton's death were unknown and troubling for his family, especially for his mother. Vicky Hinton said, I'm not myself anymore. I just can't seem to get it together. Kyron being taken away from me like that took me for a loop. I'm just not the same. It was a Saturday night in Raleigh when someone living in the 700 block of Cooper Road called 911 to report that Hinton, a family friend, was unconscious on the floor. The female caller said, he had been drinking and he passed out on my floor. I guess he was drunk. They said he was drunk when he got here. And this is according to a copy of the 911 recording obtained by the Indy from the Hinton family. The woman told the emergency dispatcher that Hinton was breathing, but he ain't awake. Kyron, 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 the woman repeated throughout the 6-minute, 20-second call. Oh, my God, Kyron, oh, my God, she said toward the end of the call while directing someone else in the home to follow the dispatcher's instruction to determine if he's breathing. She said with her voice trailing off, before identifying other people in the home, my daughter is here and my... The woman was breathing heavily when she told the dispatcher with growing alarm that Hinton had a heartbeat, but she wasn't sure if he was breathing. Paramedics who arrived at the home rushed him to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The 911 caller said people at the home told her Hinton was drunk before he arrived. But a toxicology report by the state medical examiner indicates the presence of cocaine, but ethanol, the intoxicating ingredient in alcoholic beverages, was not detected in his blood. According to a summary of events leading to Kyron's death from the state medical examiner, quote, he was reportedly led into a friend's home after asking to use the bathroom. When the police arrived, the residents inside the home on Cooper Road told the police that while Kyron was outside the home, he, quote, was observed talking nonsense, yelling, and acting strange. And continuing the medical examiner's report, once inside the residence, he began damaging items with continued yelling and was restrained by another individual. At some point, he was observed to be unresponsive on the floor. Freeman said last week, the juvenile responsible for Hinton's death either acted in self-defense or attempted to restrain him with devastating results. In addition to neck fractures, Hinton also had blunt force injuries to his head, chest, and extremities, according to the autopsy, which classified his death as a homicide. Hinton says Freeman previously told her the juvenile restrained her son, but, quote, did not intend to kill him, or that there was any evidence that he had. But Hinton says, but the autopsy says homicide. Before hearing news about the child's involvement in Kyron's death, Hinton's family members thought the police were responsible. Their belief held some credence. Court records show that one of the state troopers involved in assaulting Hinton, Michael Blake, had a history of beating the hell out of black motorists. In 2016, Blake was involved in the vicious beating of a motorist that left the man with head injuries, broken ribs, and a collapsed lung. Blake was not criminally charged or disciplined for the 2016 incident near Cary. Moreover, days before Blake was charged with felony assault against Kyron Hinton, a disabled Navy veteran filed a complaint with the NC Industrial Commission accusing the former state trooper of assaulting her during a traffic stop in Briar Creek. The motorist accused Blake of pulling her out of the car, throwing her on the ground face first, and jumping on her back. Hinton told the Indy last week, I don't know. I just think the police did it. Dominique Sanders, Hinton's niece, said she thought someone gave him a hot shot of bad drugs. The toxicology report shows that the cocaine followed in Hinton's body had been contaminated with levamisole, which is used by veterinarians to treat animals with parasitic worms. Utley, the mother of Hinton's child, told the Indy that months before his death, Hinton was worried and that he felt threatened by police. The beating Kyron Hinton endured by law enforcement first came to the public's attention in April of 2018, when this writer reported that he was brutally assaulted by officers while he was unarmed and standing in a busy street in East Raleigh. The State Bureau of Investigation launched a probe of the beating after Hinton suffered a fractured eye socket and was bitten repeatedly by a canine animal after being confronted by Raleigh police officers, Wake County Sheriff's deputies, and state troopers. The release of video and audio footage showed Hinton unarmed, yelling out, and standing in the middle of the busy road. The situation, according to the video, remained calm until former Wake County Deputy Cameron Broadwell arrived on the scene with his police dog, Loki. The former deputy yelled, "Get on the ground now or you're going to get bit," and sicked the animal on Hinton. Broadwell was charged with three felonies: assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, assault inflicting serious bodily injury, and willfully failing to discharge duties. In 2019, Broadwell pleaded guilty to one misdemeanor and received a 45-day suspended sentence on unsupervised probation. Blake and fellow former state trooper Tabitha Davis were both charged with assault, inflicting bodily injury, and willfully failing to discharge duties. Their cases are still pending today, Freeman says, and added, we don't intend to dismiss them, but the ultimate outcome is shaped by the fact that we don't have our victim living. In a 2018 interview with this writer, Vicki Hinton said her son's life was one of poverty, drugs, mental illness, and incarceration. He and his two brothers were raised by their mother in a mobile home park in southern Wake County, about 8 miles from downtown Raleigh. He stopped going to school in the sixth grade, then started dealing drugs, his mother said. In May 2003, 4 months after his 14th birthday, he was tried as an adult and convicted on 4 counts of armed robbery. He was released from prison 4 years later and continued to struggle with alcohol, drugs, and untreated mental health issues. Vicki Hinton said, for the most of his life, Kyron had been disrespectful. It started when he was 9, running around with his older cousins. He began to rob places with no bullets in the gun. Vicky Hinton has had her own violent encounter with law enforcement. Not long before Kyron Hinton's death, she said she was assaulted by police during a confrontation with an employee at the Family Dollar store in Garner. Hinton was living in Cary on the day her son was killed. She was sick and still recovering from her encounter with the Garner police. It was dark outside. Hinton did not have a bed and was sleeping on the floor. She said, "I was laying there thinking God's going to put me and Kyron back together to go to work in the church. I happened to look down at my phone at 8:30 p.m. and it was my son Kendall. He told me Kyron was dead and came to pick me up. By the time we got to the hospital, they said, 'Don't touch him because he's dead.'" Kyron Hinton's attorney, James Hairston of Raleigh, said the day before he was killed, Kyron requested $3,000 of his settlement money, but family members said Kyron didn't have a dime or any identification on him when he died. The remainder of the settlement money he received went to an estranged wife. Not a dime went to 10-year-old Kyra, whom he had with Utley before Hinton married, the family said. "Not one black penny," Utley says. For Kyra, the pain of her father's death still lingers, and Utley says, "She still has her moments of working through the grief of losing her father. It was traumatic for her, and it changed her." Well, here comes Lee Taus now with an article posted to the food and drink section of Indie Week. Whole Hog. Raleigh's Sam Jones Barbecue isn't cutting any corners, she writes. A confession. Before moving to Raleigh, I rarely ate pork. It's not because I grew up in a Jewish household. My family didn't keep kosher in Connecticut, but more so because my parents and seemingly everyone else in the Northeast has no clue how to cook a hog. Every chop I'd try was bone dry and tasteless, the kind you overchew because you dread swallowing. So with the exception of bacon, that's what I thought pork was, a flavorless gray hunk of blah. Thankfully, the swine at Sam Jones Barbecue opened in February of this year at West 502 West Lenore Street, tucked away just west of the city center, is anything but blah. It's both sweet and savory, and the naturally smoky flavors need minimal accoutrements. That's because this place isn't taking any shortcuts. On a busy day, they barbecue 3 whole hogs, head and all, on a massive grill. This is the second Sam Jones Barbecue Outpost. The first opened in Winterville, that's near Greenville, in 2015. The Raleigh location formerly housed Dusty's Garage and pays homage to the auto shop with a photo of Dusty's family on the wall and by retaining the original flooring, scratches and all, giving the space a unique feel. Sam Jones has its own celebrated history. Sam learned the ropes from his grandfather, Pete Jones, who perfected the family's classic Eastern North Carolina barbecue recipe at the Skylight Inn, which opened in Aden, North Carolina, in 1947. Skylight rose to national prominence for its classic whole hog approach. Adam Bauer, the kitchen manager at the Raleigh location, says, "We don't cut any corners. Nothing here is frozen. Everything comes in fresh. We don't have a freezer on site. We really take pride in passing on that southern hospitality that you would find in your home here to the guests. Seasoning is minimal, just salt, pepper, hot sauce, and vinegar, and the magic all happens on the grill. At about 1 p.m., 3 whole hogs sliced down the center are placed on that grill at 250 degrees until about 10 p.m. Then they'll cut the heat but keep the hogs in overnight so they continue to cook. In the morning, they fire up the heat again and crisp the skin. The hogs then get chopped up and the skin is removed but mixed back in to add a hint of that charred and smoky texture. Bauer says, it all comes together and equals this perfect bite in your mouth. When I stopped by on a recent Thursday evening, the restaurant was mostly empty. A rarity, I hear, as there's often a line out the door at lunch and dinner. But soon after we took our seats outside in the picnic benches, families and couples started filing in. I ordered the three-meat combo with ribs, smoked turkey, and the classic pork, with a side of sweet slaw and collard greens. It comes with a dense hunk of cornbread that feels almost like a brick. That's because it's not meant to be gnawed alone. Its ultimate utility is found in soaking up the extra sauce and meat. Those sides were on point, with a slaw so finely chopped it's hard to tell what's in it. Not that it matters. It's delicious. The ribs are another popular Sam's staple, juicy and flavorful, yet with an appropriate amount of char. I quickly stripped them to the bone. The turkey wasn't particularly memorable, but the pork more than delivered, with its perfect balance of salty, savory goodness. If you can save room for dessert, I'd recommend the banana pudding, a sweet and spongy delight. But if you'd rather drink to help you digest, the Jay the Butcher cocktail is an old-fashioned, with pig fat-infused bourbon to give it a unique, smoky flavor. You can find hot new takes on Southern-style cooking all over the downtown Raleigh food scene, but sometimes you just want to go back to the basics. Sam Jones delivers barbecue in the most classic sense. It definitely hits the spot. Lee Toss's review. Well, let's see. Looking at my schedule of time available, I might have a chance to read everything in the issue. So, Growing New Together by Madeline Crone is a music review about Blue Cactus's new album, Stranger Again. We'll pretend we're lovers, something more than friends, right beside you, but I want to be closer than this, Steph Stewart sings with mournful levity. She's climbing into Stranger Again, the title track of her upcoming album, with Mario Arnaz as Blue Cactus. The Chapel Hill-based duo's sophomore LP, Stranger Again, out May 7th, that's coming right up, on Sleepy Cat Records, is anchored with a titular sentiment that resonates with cohabitors everywhere, especially after weathering this past year at home. Though penned pre-pandemic, the yearning lamentations speak directly to weary lovers, repeating, "Let me keep you wondering. I want to be strangers again." Before there was Blue Cactus, there was Steph Stewart and the Boyfriends. Arnaz, a South Florida native who picked up the guitar in his mid-teens, was one of the backing string players and co-writers before he became Stewart's suitor. In the new band, Stewart drew on the early influences of her grandfather's Johnny Cash and Patsy Cline records back home in Catawba County, and expanded upon his knowledge of the country sound. After a second record, Nobody's Darling, with the Boyfriends in 2015, Stewart and Arnaz made their eponymous debut in 2017 as Blue Cactus, expanding upon regional bluegrass traditions into a mid-century classic country sound. Following their debut release, the duo spent a week at the Wild Acres residency in Little Switzerland, North Carolina. Up in the mountains, they found ample space for creativity and headed home with a few songs that they humbly offer, wrote themselves. Between the 2017 retreat and the recording their second album in 2019, the two penned an entire track list. Stewart, who was on the closing end of a divorce and in the early phases of her relationship with Arnaz, feels she derived the songs from emotional contusions and healing. She said over the phone on a Friday afternoon, in reference to the new record, "It's a lot about relationships, growing apart from people when you're with him all the time and having to maintain a relationship, even more so when it's long-term. Sometimes, to be who you want to be, you're not going to make everyone happy, and I had to come to terms with that. Stranger Again was recorded with a bass player and co-producer, Alex Bingham, from His Golden Messenger, at his lake house turned second site of his Hillsboro-based Bedtown Studios. The lakeside set up in the mountains of Virginia has become a recording retreat of sorts for Triangle artists. Over 8 days, Blue Cactus tracked the album almost entirely live, backed by Bingham on bass, drummer and creative collaborator Gabe Anderson from Sleepy Cat Records, and Nashville-based pedal steel player Whit Wright, and engineered with Ryan Johnson and Saman Kujinian. Blue Cactus first established themselves as fervent followers of early 1960s country traditions. The debut collection was embellished with experimental overdubs and characterized by a wailing vocal delivery best displayed in Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man. Stranger Again bears a palpable vulnerability with an unadorned take on storytelling. Arnaz says, beyond recording almost all of these songs live, one of the bigger shifts on this album is a more personal approach to our songwriting. Worried Man evolved immensely under Bingham's advice. That song dates back to the boyfriend's days, ideated as a bluegrass-leaning tribute to Stewart's grandfather, who was the worrier of her family. And Stewart says, it's such a gift to have someone thinking about you all the time. I didn't realize that until he was gone. When it came time to record it for the first time, Bingham twisted the classically structured tune into a disco groove, invoking early outlaw sounds introduced by the likes of Waylon Jennings. This was an apt approach to honor the man who introduced Stewart to that country western sound. Much of the lyrical content is rooted in years past, and yet, overlaid with the current context, the message is undying. Rodeo Queen and Radio Man speak to the toxicity that social media presents, especially to the creative community, and the dilemma of a digitally streaming world. Stewart says, one of my favorite things about this record is how it feels even more relevant today than when we recorded it. It holds new meaning in a lot of ways. She points to I Can't Touch You as an obvious example of this irony within current social distancing measures. The theme of constantly evolving relationships grows increasingly evident as each of the 10 tracks rolls as vintage vignettes of a universal phenomenon coalescing into a retro country collection. Pedal steel sears through the album opener, Blue as the Day, setting the tone through lingering gloom. Skylar Goodage vocal offerings on Rebel add a nostalgia-tinged jubilance to the confident mile marker for Arnaz, that is, bidding adieu to freedom-filled 20s and devoting himself to his partnership. Come Clean reckons with a painful conclusion as Stewart thinks, I think it's time I got it right with me because I've been becoming everybody I never wanted to be. Stranger Again is told by someone who has drifted from the familiarity of a previously congenial partnership, now longing for the mysterious excitement that being a stranger once brought. She says, when you start a relationship, you have so much to learn about each other, so much potential. It's weird that when it ends, it's often because you don't know each other anymore. The duo captures the brokenness of this full circle effect with perseverance through painful emotional processing and the stillness of the pandemic. In harmony with the late August cicada chorale that first inspired the album nearly 4 years ago in their creaky cabin at Wild Acres, Blue Cactus evokes a celestial soundscape of mid-century heartbreak. Rather than attempt to fix what's broken, this prickly pair of cosmic country artists embrace it. Again, that's Stranger Again, the album from Blue Cactus, released on May 7th by Sleepy Cat Records. And again, from the arts column, Byron Woods talks about The Edges of Time, a Playmakers Repertory Company offering from Monday, May 3rd to Sunday, this Sunday, online at playmakersrep.org. Also from playmakersrep.org, a panel discussion, Where Are We Now? Black Women in Journalism. Playmakersrep.org, where you'll find both of those. Byron Woods writes, Jacqueline Lawton was angry. The award-winning playwright and dramaturg at the UNC Chapel Hill Department of Dramatic Art was deep into a semester-long fellowship for a new work that was sparked by the attacks on journalism that had become prevalent under the Trump administration. Her research led her to the story of Marvel Cook, a writer, journalist, and civil rights activist who broke boundaries when she became the first black woman to be hired as a reporter at a mainstream, read, white-owned American newspaper, the Daily Compass of New York, in 1950. Before that landmark job, Cook worked as an editorial assistant to W.E.B. Du Bois and a critic at the NAACP magazine The Crisis, subsequently reporting for the New York Amsterdam News and editing at a weekly New York paper, The People's Voice. Her labor activism, organizing New York's first chapter of the Newspaper Guild, and political and civil rights work with activists including Paul Robeson, gained the attention of Senator Joseph McCarthy, who subpoenaed and grilled Cook in 1953 before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Lawton's fury at never having heard of her before was tinged with a different emotion, grief. She says, how different would my life have been if I'd known her history, known this woman advocated for us so strongly and protested by taking to the streets, leaving her job to tell the stories of people who look like me. Lawton wrote her latest drama, Edges of Time, to make sure Cook's story was remembered. Playmakers Repertory Company gave the one-person show its world premiere in a production starring veteran actor Catherine Hunter Williams, whose live-streamed performance was made available as video on demand in March and early April. The company revived that online production this week in honor of World Press Freedom Day on May the 3rd. Patrons can view the work online through this Sunday night, May the 9th. The drama finds Cook in the company of friends on the morning of September 16th, 1963, the day after the horrific bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. It's a turning point. Quote, a moment that sort of stopped a nation, as director Jules Odendahl-James notes. The moment also poses a direct challenge to Cook herself. Blacklisted after the McCarthy hearings, the former reporter hadn't worked as a journalist in a decade. Lawton says, I tried to imagine how bereft she must have felt. She didn't have a newsroom to run to. She couldn't say, let's pick up some petty cash. I'm heading to Birmingham to get on the ground in this. She didn't have a byline to tell this story. It's a moment of transition, the show's director thinks many can relate to. Within the context of recent history and present-day events, it's a catalyst that prompts Cook's character to look, react, and ask herself what she can actually do. Odendahl-James says, many of us spent the most of the last administration trying to ask that question. What do you do when life and the structures that you want to critique also give structure to your daily life, including your job, your education, and your community space? If you want to push back against those, you're still relying on them to have some stability. And it seemed like everything was slipping from our grasp. The director concludes that finding a moment like that in Cook's life let's today's audiences join her. Quote, there were so many moments from January 2017 on where we found ourselves having to confront and ask, how do we do it? How do we be activists, grapple in public with what's happening, and try to reshape it? Cook was an unrelenting critic of the journalism of her time, with an insider's damning knowledge of the industry's frequent shortcomings. In Lawton's script, after reading the New York Times cover story on the church bombing, her character concludes, "This reporting isn't for the black people of Birmingham. It can't be. There's no way to comfort people in mourning, and it certainly won't reassure a community that is rightfully enraged. Excuse me." Moments later, she bluntly tells her audience, "I don't trust newspapers." In coming to terms with Cook's unsparing, candid critiques, Lawton recalls having to stop and ask, "Wait, what is she actually saying? I thought about James Baldwin, who said, 'I love America more than any other country in the world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually.'" Lawton goes on, "I think about my relationship with the United States as someone who's had the fortune to travel to other countries. I think of my relationship with the American theater, which I love, but I'm going to critique it to the edge of its life because of its exclusionary practices. That's what she's doing." And Lawton concludes, "Cook looks at the field she loves, and she's saying, 'Damn it, we can be better than this. We are better than this. We have principles. Let's follow them.'" And again, this is Byron Wood's article about Edges of Time, available online through playmakersrep.org. That's $24 to view this one woman production. And then there is a free panel discussion on black women in journalism, also at playmakersrep.org. And all we missed on this issue's reading is a little interview with Erin Lynn of her third grade class at Durham's Central Park School for Children, who recently collected more than $2,000 for the Animal Protection Society of Durham. And it's a short little interview with Ariana and her class. Well, that was pretty good. Thanks for listening. That went pretty well, I think. Got it all in. Well, thanks for listening to Indie Week, presented by the ncreadingservice.org. And we also save it in our podcast section. So John Federson signs off now and intends to mention that theme musicians in future weeks when I can. Oh, wait. Our director's telling me I may just have time if I would just, what, hush up and do it? Oh, okay, I can do it. So, our musicians, they are the world famous...